Maybe we can just begin slowly. Marco, thanks a lot for taking the time to speak with me and Yuri. A few years ago, we already spoke with your colleague, Mina, and that was a really nice and insightful conversation. And today, we would like to get also some of your insights from working at Drogard and what's your experience, where do you come from? And then we can dive into some of the topics that we prepared. And of course, some of the topics that we will discover along the way. And maybe we can start just how did you get into Drogard and what's your story? How long have you been there?
Okay. Also thank you for inviting me. So basically my story goes maybe 12 years ago. So I was around 23, 24 years. It was connected with the drugs. So I went to Erasmus exchange in Prague, where I discovered the nightlife and also drugs. So I started this my personal journey, and at that time I have some my own personal difficulties, so my drug use went a bit out of control at some point I decided to say, okay, you should do something more meaningful in your life. I was at that time finishing my studies in computer science and math, and I was never seeing myself as this IT guy. So I decided to start volunteering, and I went through all the possibilities that in Slovenia was on a portal, and I found Drogard, and I was like, okay, I already like to go out, I like clubbing, I like to talk with people, and I said, okay, I think this is something that called me. So I applied, and then I started to work, and as a volunteer in Drogard, I gained this experience also how to be out and not taking anything, because yeah, we have certain rules that while you're working you have to be sober, and you have an important job if somebody is needing help, etc. So slowly and slowly Drogard in fact helped me to pass my maybe my own drug issues. And I really found myself there. So I was working a lot, and already I think after 2.5 years of volunteering, they offer me like a job, permanent job. So I was just finishing my studies, and I said, yeah, I will take it because I was having a really good time there. And this is how my story as an employee at Drogard started. Then through the last 10 years, I was coordinating volunteers and talking with organizers, trying to make nightlife settings more safe. And then last 4 or 5 years, I'm in charge of drug checking service that we provide at Drogard. So now I'm more into monitoring the markets and seeing what's up there to warn people and to collaborate also with a system a bit. So yeah, but still, I'm in contact with the nightlife, with clubbing, with festivals. So basically, that's it. Now we are here in this podcast.
Yeah. Okay, so we can go maybe one by one through the topics. And the first one I would like to touch, and if you are comfortable with sharing, if with as much detail as you are comfortable with, what was your first experience with substance like? Let's say concretely, what was the party? What was the setting? And for example, you also mentioned personal difficulties. You don't have to go into detail, but just like in concept, what kind of period were you going through, and which answers did substances give you? Let's say, why did you have that unpleasant experience along the way in the upcoming months?
Yeah, my first experience, I'm considering drugs like everything, so it was alcohol. probably with my parents, that they offer me some beer some at, when I was even minor. But like concretely that I got drunk was like in primary school at the end, then in high school was some weed. But like if we go into a party setting, yeah, it was my first ecstasy pill in Ambassada Gavioli, I think in I was in high school around, I don't know, I was 18, 19. And it was an amazing experience, but I just had this one experience and then for a longer time, I didn't do again or going clubbing. So then I continue my life and yeah, then I went to Erasmus and there I met some people and yeah, you have a lot of opportunities for parties and you met a range of people and somehow I get into more heavy drug use there. So it was half year, but yeah, I tried a lot. It was all fun, amazing time because yeah, you're on Erasmus, so you have a lot of time and also money, no worries. I also managed to do all my exams. Then I come back and then yeah, I learned something there, so I continue this process. And for a year and a half, I was partying a lot, like every weekend and a lot of drugs. But yeah, you asked me about my difficulties. Then yeah, I'm very honest about myself, so I have no problem sharing everything. So I was at that time with a girl. I had a girlfriend, and but I was in the closet, so I was always thinking like, okay, is this life, will I be hiding forever, and I will have family and kids, and parties were a place to escape this thinking. And at one moment I managed to come out of the closet and I solved, I think, all the issues that I have. And also at that point, my drug consumption went in a normal way of doing it. So yeah, I experienced this, what we are many times addressing, that using drugs to solve your problems can lead you in dangerous places. But
so
for me, it was okay.
Would you say you were kind of prolonging or escaping that moment where, or of the burden of being in the closet, or how people will see you? You were just prolonging with the drug use, or is that the case?
I mean, yeah, for sure. When I look back now, I don't know why I was so afraid to come out and say I'm gay. But at that point, before you're doing it, you're full of fears. So you run away from these feelings. And also party settings give you, I think, the acceptance. You can be whoever you want to be. Nobody's judging you. So yeah, I think I felt safe. And at the same time, I was escaping my inner thoughts and inner fights.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned while you were at Erasmus Exchange that there was a certain, you know, when we are students, there's a lack of responsibility. You know, you don't have so much responsibility in your life. Do you think that can also be one of the reasons why this age group can fall for substances more easily than any other? Or do you think that maybe if you have too much responsibility in your life, then you can't handle the pressure and then you also go and seek exit in substances?
With young brain, the problem is that you don't develop yet this part when you know what is a responsible way of living. So your brain is functioning a bit differently, so you cannot make a risk assessment very well. And also, while you are in adolescent, it's then that people like to risk. So in this way, when you risk, then you see where is the boundary, where you cross it, and then you learn something. So it's a time when you learn. And drugs are like very good tool to do that, but the dangerous one. So you can really experience push the boundaries, learn new things. But yeah, as you are not developed yet, it's easy that you will go too far. So yeah, when we are doing our work, we talk with young people, then this magic age is like 25. At that point, you should be fully developed adult. But when I'm saying like developed, I don't mean like physically, because yeah, you're already at 19 or 20. But your brain and your response to life issues, difficulties, risk.
And maybe I'm jumping a bit now, but you said the age 25 when your brain fully develops, or just like some like average age where like 90% of the people usually develop their brain. Would it be safer? So you mean it would be safer for drug or substance use after the year 25?
Yeah, for sure. I think if I look at my example, I started quite late, so I was already 23 or something. And deep inside, I knew that what I'm doing, that it's not like the best. And I think I already managed to develop this being, responsible adult. So I knew that I have a problem, that I'm solving this with drugs. But with, like, if you're 16 and you start using, I don't know, cocaine or any other drugs, you don't develop these skills, and you will never see that you have issues and how to tackle them and how to address them or how to react when you notice something. You will not even notice probably the problems. The environment will, but for you it will take quite a long time that you realize something. Probably usually something bad happens. So yeah, 25 is, I think, the best way, but yeah, the reality is different. So it's,
yeah.
And probably we are different from one and another. You know, somebody can maybe realize that they might be having a problem in the future and they stop before they get there. And some people have to, you know, go to the line and check, okay, this is the line. Probably some people also jump over the line. And what do you think is like a general percentage? Do you think that everybody has to go, let's say, at least to the line to see where it is? Or is there like a majority of people that don't even have to come to this line to realize, okay, I'm going in the wrong direction?
Yeah, if I connect this to like the percentage of people who ever use drugs and they develop like risky drug use or some difficulties, it's like around 10%, I think. So probably this 10% go over the line and maybe stay there, maybe some came back. And other 90%, I think they go a bit over the line, but they realize maybe it's not this for all the time and that there are other important things in life. So, yeah. I mean, but it's always connected also with your, I think, past experiences from childhood and stuff like this. And why do you use drugs itself? Because, yeah, we know that drugs gives you some good effects. Otherwise, nobody would use them. So it's always important to ask why I'm using something. And if it's for fun, and then it's okay. Also, I think many times we don't discuss like the positive effects of drugs. Like if you go just to make a quick research on like PubMed or any other webpage for scientific research and you search for like positive effects of illicit drugs, I don't think you will find many research. But if you look at the negative, there is like tons of research. So we didn't really research what are the positive maybe effects, because yeah, people are using them. It's risky. But again, at the end, I don't know, maybe some people bond, make a connections. We are social beings. So we need a bit of this. But as it's dangerous, yeah, the system always is researching just the negative effects. But I'm not saying now that drugs should be normalized all the day. They are still risky. But if you want to have a better insight, you also have to look at this side, I think. So why people are using, what gives you like the ketamine, why you want to use it every day, or why you want to use it like every 3 months. Can you, you know, so you have broader range of emotions and feelings and clearer picture at the end.
Yeah, it's good that you were saying about like, okay, that there's a less positive or less researched positive things about drug use or drug even abuse, whatever, than negative things. But how is like, why is such a, could you maybe answer why is such a stigma for drug use, or maybe even how was the stigma before when you were, I don't know, 25 or between 20 to 25, and how is the stigma like now? Is, do parents like understand like just a little amount maybe, or they understand the experimenting and stuff, or are we still in the like time where people are super conservative and don't and want to like hold to their belief that it's only bad?
You have all the range of parents and range of kids. But if there, I don't think there was a big shift in perception of drug stigmatization. You can see a little bit changing in cannabis attitudes, as usually stigmatization is all quite connected with general population, media, politics. And with cannabis, we could see in the past that people start to promote that it has a medical value. There were like some trying for legalization. So more and more was talking like in a positive way. So I think that attitudes toward cannabis changed, which I don't, at the end, you never know if it's a good thing or not. For sure, stigmatization in a way that people are stigmatized just because they're using drugs, it's not good. But if stigmatization prevents somebody using heroin at 16 years old, then it's good. So it's always, I think, a balance between these attitudes and normalization. It's not clear what is the best way. So I think, like I said, I don't think there is a bigger change. Maybe new generations, they have more easy approach to drugs, and it's less stigmatized, as we see that it's spreading out of sub, like in 10 years ago, usually drugs were connected to nightlife, especially electronic music. And now we are seeing this shift that drugs are coming out of this subpopulation of rave culture to general events, like also we could observe drug use in very rural places in Slovenia, where cocaine is now a bit getting popular, when 20 years ago people were just totally drunk. So as more drugs are coming into general population, I think the attitudes will be changing a bit, yes.
And do you think that we will ever reach a point where some drugs that are in more general use, like alcohol and cigarettes, will be stigmatized as much as drugs are, let's say, the others you mentioned, like party drugs? Why is there such a big gap, you know, between these two stigmas? Because we all know how many lives cigarettes and alcohol takes, and how many party drugs, for example, if we just take these two broad examples. Why do you think that is so?
First, these two are legal, so this is one, the strongest point. So,
but why are they legal? That's like the question. What do you think?
Why are they legal? Probably there is culture aspect with alcohol. The tradition of brewing alcohol goes way back. and it was very well spread. Everybody was drinking, so it was accepted. The cigarettes, same. And now, for sure, everybody knows it's dangerous, probably the same amount as illicit drugs. But there are like two big industries behind both tobacco and alcohol, which try to promote both of the substances as not problematic. And yeah, it's very easy accessible. And yeah, that's it. But yeah, I think it would be, if we just like make an assumption and go like 200 years back and said, okay, cocaine is now legal and everybody would be using cocaine and alcohol would be forbidden. And now we would have like maybe the same question, why alcohol is like, it's just the perception of people, what they are seeing in media, in real life, from the family, from the environment.
Yeah, they have, how should I say, they have a very different branding to them.
Yeah. You know?
And then the public perception also, and what happens and what gets exposed and stuff like that. I want to go a little bit back when you mentioned that there are also some positive sides on the substance use. Obviously, one is partying. But let's say, what can be other, if I use the term like really softly, positive effects of using different party substances? What do you see, let's say, in everyday life?
I mean, for sure, for some people, it's to relieve some stress, to vent after, I don't know, long day at work. I think it's like you can compare this to having a dinner with a bottle of wine with your friends, or you go partying and you take an ecstasy pill. I think it's totally the same, just that one is forbidden and stigmatized, and everybody's saying that it's, big risks. And if you drink a bottle of wine with your friends, it's a very nice way of having a nice evening and celebrations and everything positive connected. So you can just, I think, copy this, what you already experienced with alcohol and socialization to all the drugs. But yeah, every drug use is risky. Even glass of wine can be risky, or an ecstasy pill. But yeah, people are dancing, knowing other people, sharing ideas, meeting new people, I don't know, finding love. So these are all positive aspects. For sure, without drugs would be also possible, but drugs usually boost a bit of those things, and that's why they're, and that we are seeing them.
Yeah, we kind of had back in the day, I don't know, 5 or 7 years ago, we had a saying with David, I mean, you don't need running shoes to run, you know, but it helps. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and really what you said on top of that, would you agree that it is very important that you know before you go into something, like why you are using whatever you're using? How do you view that, and how do you speak to different people that come and test substances at DrogArt? Can you maybe give us an example of how this conversation can go, and what kind of questions do you try to answer?
Like the drug checking service is like harm reduction approach to tackle issues connected to black markets. So as black market is not regulated, people can use substances that they don't even tend to. So they buy something and it's something else, or it has have some dangerous adulterant. So this tackle this problem. But you have to know that drug checking service is not just like chemical analysis, so that drug users give me the sample, I send it to the lab and I give him back the result. But it's a part when I can have a conversation with this person about drug he brought and about his patterns of drug use and why he or she is using them, how often, if she or he ever felt some difficulties, and try to also promote safer drug use. And if we see that somebody is like having bigger issues, then we also refer them to counseling service. So it's, yeah, it's more like a service when you monitor also drug market and also monitor a bit of drug users and try to give them some advice that would help them. And yeah.
And do you approach these conversations differently? Let's say if a person comes to drug art and they are 20 years old, or if they are 30 years old, or if they are 40 years old. Are there any differences in your approaches to speaking with them?
For sure. Yeah, for young people, we have a bit different protocol. Usually you try to address this issue that we talked before already about this 25 years and developing, and you are more concerned and you are maybe trying to show them that he or she can still wait a bit and try to find alternatives and to reduce the drug use. But if somebody who is already 30 or 40 and if he decided to use drugs, it's his decision at the end. I don't try to change his mind or something. It's his choice. It's very important in harm reduction approach that you're always coming from the user himself. So I never promote something that I think is good for you. But I ask you, okay, do you use too much? And if he said no, I said, okay, then fine. If he said yes, then I said, okay, how much do you use? How much would be okay with you? Then you tackle the issues that come from users that they say, I think this is my problem, or I think I don't have a problem. So yeah, we never try to give them our opinions.
But how often do people come and they say they have a problem?
Yeah, usually people don't come and say, I have a problem. I mean, for sure, in counseling service, they're directly contacting us. But in drug checking, it's a bit different idea why somebody come to drug checking service, because we want to check something. So I don't know, sometimes people just need, you know, some conversation, and some people are coming more often. So yeah, it can be the first time that you just go through really basic harm reduction practices and about the markets and the dangerous issues there. And this is how you start to make trustful connection. And maybe she or he will return next time and he will be a bit more open. And then you start to know people and you see more into depth into their use. And then you address, I don't know, if somebody is saying that every time he goes out and he black out or overdose, then for sure I address this and I ask like, but do you think this is okay for you? That you are not remembering anything? And if you say no, and do you want to change this? And he said yes. And then we continue in this way and try to find solutions. So it's very basic conversations, but users are leading. So
yeah. And how would you say trends in popularity of drug choices changed in the last 10 years?
How it changed?
Yeah, I mean, are there any differences? I don't know, back in the day there was, as you said, there was ecstasy. As of now, when we do own events with David, it's not much ecstasy left. I barely remember anybody who would take like pure ecstasy. It's mostly MDMA or ketamine or something else. How do you see it as a professional?
Yeah. I can go like for 2008, 20 years ago, then you have these traditional drugs like cocaine, amphetamine, MDMA, which was usually ecstasy, like you said. There was already GHB and some psychedelics, and then heroin, but not in party population. So this was basically it. Then in 2008, we saw this shift in markets because there was MDMA was not available. So because it was connected to production of safrole, which is a precursor of making for making MDMA. And in 2008, Europe stays without MDMA. So people were still demanding. There was still a demand for this drug. And then the producers were looking for alternatives. And this is how methadone entered the drug markets. Methadone is having quite similar effects to MDMA. So people who were looking for MDMA said, okay, methadone is, if I don't get anything else, then it's fine for me. So methadone spread at 2008. And this is the time when we see the phenomena of new psychoactive substances entering drug markets. And it was so people, producers realized that if they put a new drug on the market, it's still not forbidden. So it's legally to sell it and trafficking it. And they were trying to find new and new drug that they could offer to the people. And we saw from 2008 until I think 2015, 2016, this that we were looking all the time for new drugs and we didn't know what are the effects, what are the risks. So it was quite confusing times. But then MDMA a bit slowly and slowly were, it was coming back. They found new precursors how to produce MDMA. So drug market of MDMA became stable again. And people didn't want to use new drugs. So nowadays we can see that people went back to traditional drugs like it was 20 years ago, but there are some new guys there. So methadone and 3-MMC, which are quite similar drugs, so 3 and 4-MMC, are now part of this, let's say, list of drug of choices of people that we are seeing on the party scene. For example, GHB, we can see like in the waves, we have like some years that it's a bit peaking and then we don't detect it as much as before. So I think it also connected with number of, I don't know, overdoses. And then people said, okay, I'm fed up of this. So they stopped using it and the new generation came and maybe there will be again peak. And ketamine is the phenomena from last, let's say, 5 years. I think it started in Berlin and UK again. They're usually the trendsetters. And then usually spread through Europe. And yeah, now the ketamine is the same prevalence we are seeing as for MDMA and amphetamine almost. So yeah, quite a lot.
And why do you think ketamine now has the popularity in the last 5 years? Why, let's say, not before? And how did Corona affect the general recreational drug use from your information, also from the field trips?
Why ketamine? I would say that a lot of drug users are already aware of all the effects of different drugs. So I don't know if you're going to parties for 5 years or for 10 years. Like taking the MDMA, for sure, it's not the same as it was the first time you took it or the first 20 times. So it's not so exciting anymore. So ketamine was a bit a new drug with very specific effect that you couldn't get from stimulants or from psychedelics, everything in between. So I think because it offers users like really totally new specter of effects that they were really brought into it. Ketamine also have this, how to say, factor that people can be okay next day after use. So there is no such a big downside at the beginning. And as people who are partying a lot, maybe it was a safer way that they don't experience this depression and Monday blues after partying. but still get some effects. So yeah, but also I think it's the culture, maybe the music changes, and you know, I think that also depends on the music. There goes also the prevalence of drug use, I think. So I don't know, on probably on drum and bass, when you have to be very energetic to dance, I would say, this is my guessing, I don't know for sure, but I would say there is more amphetamine and cocaine than MDMA, and on some techno, yeah, it's like MDMA, and like now I think also with this more dark events like ketamine. So yeah, it's probably there is a correlation, but I don't know if somebody was researching this.
And can we say that there is also a correlation between personality types and types of drugs that go along with that personality types? Example, are introvert people more prone to use a certain type of substance, let's say, in comparison to extrovert? Do you see any correlations here?
I don't know in from general side, but for sure, when you're talking to people, yeah, usually, yeah, drugs give you some effects, and there are different drugs from different categories. We have stimulants, we have psychedelics, dissociatives, we have depressants. And usually it answers some of your issues that you have, maybe, that you like specific drug more than maybe other person would. So, for example, maybe for somebody who is a bit, I don't know, social anxious, and it's hard for him to communicate with others, then maybe MDMA, which is also empathogen and increases this empathy and connection with other people, then probably would be MDMA, maybe has a bigger chance to be drug of choice than, I don't know, some benzodiazepines or, I don't know, psychedelics, which makes you be even more anxious with other people.
And we mentioned now a few times already that substances are offering us specific answers to some of the issues, for example, that we cannot answer ourselves, most of them being like psychological problems and issues. And do you think there's a way, or how should people approach solving their problems, specifically mental ones, before they go into substance use? What would you recommend to somebody who has, I don't know, anxiety issues or something like that? Can these problems be tackled before, and how should I say, in a sober way?
Yeah, for sure. It has to be tackled before, because if you already have like mental issues, I don't think any drug use is recommended, as it can really make things quite worse. But for sure, drugs, like if you go to psychiatrists, they will also give you specific drugs, a bit different. But yeah, they are working in a way that you can feel better. And we can see now, especially with young population, this self-treating, a way, not as part of the health system, not part of going to psychologist or psychiatrist and tackle this problem, but they go to black market, they find some like benzodiazepines, anxiolytics, and they treat their anxiety by themselves, which is very risky because you don't have any control. You don't see yourself going maybe too fast into addiction. So this is quite dangerous. But you know, the reality, what we observe now, like there is a young person, and he has this meeting with psychologist, but in 2.5 years, this is the health system we are living in now. So for 2.5 years, he will struggle, and of course he will probably try to find some solutions. And for some people, drugs are the way of solving problems, which, yeah, they are working, but the problem is that usually they work for some time, and then when this time is over, then you will find yourself in much worse situation if you use drugs for solving the mental health problem. So that's why, like you said, it's always very important that you think about your mental health state. So this is kind of setting. Probably people know this from using psychedelics, but it goes for all kind of drugs. So if you, I don't know, if you go through divorce and you use MDMA, doesn't mean that this experience will be pleasant. It can be very difficult and you can have very negative effects. So it's very important that you feel okay with yourself and with your own drug use. And that environment, so where you will be using, so is this a club or home with friends, it's positive. So these two things are important when you decide to use drugs.
Would you say younger people are more introspective in terms of conversation you have with them on testings, or even like general observation of people using?
It really depends on the person. Yeah, some young people are very, they don't care, they don't listen, they think they know the best. But some are very open to new information and they really want to read everything before try anything. And they know a lot. So yeah, we have the whole spectrum of different people there. But I would say that younger are like students. I think when people are like 20, more than 22, 23, they become more aware and they accept, I think, information a bit better than when they are 16, 18 or 20.
Yeah. And I lost my thought. I'm sorry. David, you are here with us?
Yeah, we also mentioned the... Hello, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, we also mentioned therapeutic, like scientific positive effects of MDMA also in PTSD. I remember we spoke about this with Mina a few years ago. Can you tell us a little bit about where we are with these processes?
Yeah, we are observing now the psychedelic renaissance in terms of using psychedelics to treat some mental health issues. So for now, if we go directly to like medical research, they show like positive effects on PTSD with MDMA and depression for ketamine. But we have to be careful here. It's not like all kind of depression. It's like resistant depression. So people who already tried all the things that we have already and nothing worked, all the medication didn't work, then they start with ketamine. And this is a bit problematic because, yeah, with this type of research and people who are using ketamine, they are aware that, yeah, ketamine is now antidepressant, so they can reduce the awareness of risks, as if they are using this for medical purposes, so what can be wrong? So we have on one side this, and on the other side, that's really some drugs are really effective for some things. But it's always important, I think, with psychedelic research and psychedelic treatment that we do this not like typically in a medical way, so that there would be like a hospital that you would get a medication and then you will be treated. It's just one part. It has to be connected with some psychotherapy and some preparation, and after this, another conversations with this person. So now we are in a way that we don't know in which direction it will go, who will be the strongest in this area, as many professionals have their own opinions. And if we look now, yeah, in like our system, usually doctors has the most powerful voice, so psychiatrist. But we see that usually this is not like a typical medication for a psychiatry environment that it would be working. So we will see what future will bring us. But on the other hand, we also see a lot of, like these new healers that I think see more these psychedelics as a way how to earn quick money. I mean, for sure, some are okay, but we noticed this year quite problematic way of doing these ceremonies, or how they call them. So yeah, for example, in drug checking, somebody brought us a substance that he was sold is Sasafra. First time that I heard something like that. And they told him that this is like a magical root from a natural tree from Africa or something. And they use this in a ceremony of love or something. And it's totally natural, but he wants to be sure. So we, and it was in crystals. So we checked this and it was like pure MDMA, nothing else. So you have this, yeah, you have, and to these ceremonies also go like maybe older people who never had any experience with drugs. And they give you something like this is totally natural, just use it. It can be very dangerous. Some people have like already their own health issues that could be very dangerous with combination with MDMA. And I don't think people are really checking and having this conversation before these ceremonies. So yeah, we can observe that on one hand, there is this gray area of people already practicing this without any protocols, without any safe measures. And on the other hand, I think medicine wants to make this their own way, in a way of pharmaceutical, you know, that they could sell this as a new drug and earn money in this way. But I think the truth lies something in between. So it has to be like probably some collaboration between like this Western medicine and probably some alternative approaches to really find this effective. But yeah, we will see it will go.
It's first time you said, I mean, I heard that people are doing these ceremonies in Slovenia or even like in the region. It's only what I saw on like on YouTube and some like scammers and stuff, you know, and the not the collectives, but you know, the sectas and stuff.
Yeah.
But was this like often? Did you have many encounters of people bringing like stuff in to check?
Yeah.
And
I mean, often, for sure. We have several samples from people who attend one of the ceremonies. I think like 5 or 10 samples this year. So we got a bit of insight what is going on there. So yeah, we also then, as we also get information in drug checking from the users, and we saw that this is quite a dangerous practice, we warn people, we write an article about what is important with the ceremonies. And tell them that, yeah, I guess some of them are really shitty and just telling people that there is some natural substance called Sasafra, but it's pure MDMA. And this happened like several times. So yeah, it's happening already in Slovenia. For sure, you have to have this idea to go there and then make a research. And I think you will quickly find some people who are offering this.
Crazy.
And do you think these are in some way also connected to the ayahuasca ceremonies?
I mean, connected. Probably everything started with this ayahuasca phenomena when Western world discovered some kind of magical treatment for your own issues. So I think there was a lot of documentaries probably also on Vice and this media, and also in the standard media that we follow, so people knew about it. So they learned that, I guess, there are also other ceremonies that can be provided, and yeah, I think it's the start of this psychedelic renaissance, which has many different connecting points from the medical treatment to Western world discovering alternative medicine of ayahuasca. And then also, yeah, I think now also you have people who use probably ketamine to fight their own depression. And maybe even there are ceremonies with ketamine. I never heard about it, but who knows?
Maybe if you could talk about it, what was like the weirdest thing someone brought you to do a checkup on?
Yeah. The weirdest thing.
It can be a few things.
I mean, there were some calls, but we didn't accept the sample. It was too weird. I mean, somebody like said it. He think that his cake was poisoned or something and he wants to check for drugs. But yeah, we didn't go that far. But now when I think like weird things that people were, and you asked me before about the COVID, so it was connected with this time slot. During the COVID, yeah, everything was shut down. So all the parties were gone. What we saw was quite a big decrease in MDMA use. So also the producers then realized that they cannot sell anymore. So they stopped producing it. And when everything opened, again, people thrilled after 2 years, not partying. Yeah. And then there was a big, big demand of MDMA, but they couldn't produce it so fast because, you know, with COVID, it was like so fast, like one day we were locked up and then in 1 week you could party. So at that time, we detected quite some fake products on the markets that people try to sell as MDMA, but at the end was not MDMA. So we had like 1 or 2 weeks of people buying silica gel, you know, this that you get with clothes that prevent the moisture something. So yeah, this. But luckily, this is not dangerous even if you swallow it. So it was more like how to scam people without too much health concerns. This is what I remembered, for example.
So people, for example, actually took those like small plastic bags, opened them, like crushed the crystals, and like sold.
They were already in the shape of crystals, very similar to MDMA. So it was, look at this, it was quite similar. I mean, you could, if you're like an expert, you could see it's a different crystal, but an unexperienced user would probably just use this. Yeah.
Imagine like doing first time MDMA and you buy silica gel.
Yeah.
And you're like then all disappointed, or maybe, you know.
But for sure, it would work. I think it would work. Like, it's also interesting. Sometimes people bring something and, I don't know, they experience some bad effects, for example. And then we test it and it's just like normal MDMA, like 90%. And you can see in these cases, like how set and setting really influenced the effects. And they were sure that something is off with this drug because they were like having really strange thoughts and the party was awful and they didn't feel okay. Like every time I take MDMA, everything's good. But this time really it was awful. And then we tested and it's your own mind that make it bad.
Placebo or what?
Placebo, yes. Placebo. I mean, also the MDMA can give you different effects if you are not feeling okay, or if, I don't know, you don't like the music at the party, you take MDMA and then maybe you will feel even worse, you know?
Yeah, I remember. I remember a guy that I met somewhere at a party, and I knew him for 30 minutes, and it was like a really shitty party with Schlager music, you know, and he put out a bag with ecstasy, and I don't know what he did with it, but like he consumed it and it was even worse. was even worse.
Exactly. And also what I experienced with drug checking, another interesting fact when we are talking now with about the setting and placebo, how our perception also changed through time every time that we use certain drugs. For example, I had maybe this older guy in drug checking. He's using ecstasy for 15 years. And then we talked and he was commenting like, but you know, those pills that we have in 90s or early 2000s, they were different pills. This was a really different MDMA. What are they selling now is total shit, you know? But what happened here, it's not that molecule change, but the thing that he was 15 years younger at the beginning of his MDMA use. Of course, everything seemed amazing and all the experiences were new. And then you're doing this for 15 years. Of course, experience will not be the same, but it's not that the drug changed, you know? So this perception is also important to realize with yourself.
Yeah, because he was kind of chasing the moment when he was like 15 years younger, you know?
Yeah, and he has these good memories, like 90s, rave culture, everything was... subculture was very live. It was a big connection among those people. Now it's a bit different already with the club culture. And then you put drugs on this type of culture. Yeah, it will be different for sure. People are...
And how often, how often does it happen here at Drug Art that you notice a substance that was never recorded before, that you don't have it in your archives? Or is it more of like people bring different mixtures of substances?
There are a few every year that we detect for the first time. But with the drug that it would be first detected ever in the world, I don't think we detect any. But maybe it was the first detection in Slovenia, for example. There are a few. This and last year, there was a lot of new drugs connected with synthetic cannabinoids. So the 3-MMC market crashed like a year and a half ago. So again, there was no 3-MMC, but there were like similar type of drugs that were offered on the market. So we noticed and we were detecting quite many different substances. There are several new substances each year for sure.
I'm sorry, David.
What does market crash mean in this sense? Like, why does this happen? Why is one substance in such lack for a few years?
Usually it's politics. So for example, 3-MMC, this is not like 100% sure, but it was produced mostly in Netherlands. And Netherlands then put a ban on 3-MMC, and the producers already knew this. So I think they made quite a lot of quantities. And when the ban came to apply, there were still for some time, you could still get 3-MMC and they were shipping around Europe. But they already start to produce new substance that would
replace
the 3-MMC. And this was 3-CMC. And I think after all the stocks were empty, then 3-MMC appeared on the market. And then they banned 3-MMC and 3-CMC. And then we saw 4-CMC and now 2-MMC. It's always this game between production and legislation. This is in terms of, for example, like 3-MMC. But if you look at now heroin market, that is now a biggest concern that maybe we will face the appearance of fentanyl and other potent synthetic opioids.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Yeah, so I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
This is connected with, for example, with Taliban in Afghanistan, because Afghanistan was the biggest producer of poppy seed for opium, which is used to produce heroin. And when United States went out of Afghanistan, then yeah, Taliban's come back and they said, okay, we will stop producing poppy seed. I don't know the reasons, probably because of, I don't know, religion. And at that point, they decreased the production for 75%, which is seen probably from satellites. And I think the United States quite know well what's going on even before. And then there was this fear that when there is not big, where there is a demand and you cannot produce enough of heroin, then some other things can appear that would replace this demand. And the fear is for sure fentanyl that we are observing in the States that is on the market for 15 years now. But for now, what we are very closely monitoring, in Slovenia, we didn't detect any case yet. And there is already shifting, I think, the production from Afghanistan to some Southeast Asian countries like Burma. So we will see if they will be faster, then the new production will be faster. Maybe we will avoid this problem.
So you haven't seen any traces of fentanyl in Slovenia?
No. The closest to Slovenia was in Vienna, like I think a month ago, that they have one sample. There is some fentanyl in Baltic countries and in UK, but maybe not really fentanyl. There is another class of very potent synthetic opioids, which is called nitazenes. And I think these are more... they have more chances to be seen on the European drug market than fentanyl.
But why is... I mean, as far as I know, fentanyl is dangerous because it can be laced to other, like, to other drugs. For example, I don't know, but if I heard that correctly or seen that correctly, but in Germany, for example, they had fentanyl in some ecstasy pills or something, or LSD tabs or whatever. Am I correct, or is that like...
Fentanyl is dangerous just because it's very potent. So the drug itself, if you know how to dose it, it's not more dangerous than heroin itself. But like the...
I know the little dose of it is very like bigger even than morphine, 200 times or something.
Yeah. It's 100 times more potent than heroin. So you need dose like maybe 1 milligram or less, which is... if you measure with your eye, you can really be quickly on 2 milligrams, which is maybe enough that you overdose. So this is the biggest problem with fentanyl, because it's so potent that if it's in heroin sample and you don't know, you will make a dose for yourself, which you're used to, like, I don't know, 100 milligrams. And if there is like 10% of fentanyl inside, then you're overdose. If you don't have this naloxone, which is antidote, then you're dead. And this is the biggest problem, because it's so potent that if you don't know, then there is a big chance of little overdose. If you know that you have fentanyl and you want to use it, and you know how to measure these small amounts, like with volumetric measurements, so that you have really special scale, then it's like any other drug. Fentanyl is used in medicine, for example, for anesthesia and
with
the delivery of babies and stuff like that. So it's just this, that it's very hard to dose it. Yes.
Can we define quickly for somebody who doesn't know, even I didn't know the term until today, what does potent mean in this area that we are speaking right now of substances?
Potency is how much drug do you need for feeling certain effects, for example. Usually, if we measure this, like the dosage of certain drug in, like, for example, in MDMA, it's like 100 milligrams. Then some other drugs, for example, LSD is in micrograms. So you can see it. Much more potent, but people are aware of it, and it's sold in these blotters, which usually have already a certain amount that it's not too much. And then you have substances that are, like fentanyl, also very potent, which is also in micrograms. So the amount of drug that you need to get desired effect, and less the smaller the dose, more potent is the drug.
Get it. So yeah, the bigger effect it has, and potentially you can miscalculate faster, therefore being a lot more dangerous.
Exactly.
Because you can do a miscalculation. And when we see those videos, you know, from Philadelphia, from San Francisco, this is really next level. This is really scary. I think if you don't see it on your own eyes, how big of a problem this is, probably you can't even like comprehend how big of an effect that has. And something that I really don't know how to do, even in my imagination, how can cities as a whole, cities as organizations, tackle this problem and try to fix it in long term? What do you think? What are some of the potential approaches?
I think what we are seeing, those pictures from some American cities, that's a product of some deeper society issues, I would say. So I don't think there is a solution, like a quick one, that you just do something and this will be solved. If we compare Europe, for example, to the States, we know that in the United States, this really turbo capitalism is very powerful. So usually people who don't have these opportunities or are like more poor or have other difficulties, they don't have any safety, insurances. The country, I don't think they really care so much. So there is more chance that people would go so far already. And then you have big cities and then this population is very big. I think in Europe, the social welfare is more developed. So it's trying to prevent already these things to happen. We have drug check. For example, Netherlands have drug checking for 30 years. And United States, they started with drug checking after, 100,000 people died already of fentanyl. So you see they are really behind certain services. Probably addiction, harm reduction was not developed. But this is the mentality, I think, also of American style. And everything is distant and the success is very important. And people who don't do that, they don't deserve a good life and they don't care. So I think they miss opportunities in the past. So I don't think this is easy problem to solve. I would say for sure harm reduction, but also you have to change the society. But this is not a year, this is like several decades probably.
And how would you, when we were talking, or when we were talking about like harm reduction and testing substances and stuff, how is your cooperation with, not cooperation, but collaboration in some way with justice departments, for example, police and forensics and stuff. Are they in your favor? Is hard to collaborate with them, or what is your experience?
Yeah, without this collaboration, we would be not able to provide drug checking. As you know, it's illegal to possess any drug. So as I'm taking the sample from a user, I would be in an offense. The drug checking service is running under protocol signed by also the Ministry of Health and Public Health Institute. Also the police that give us green light that we can do this. They are in a favor. For sure, they have their own concerns and own way of seeing things. But I think it's okay because we are doing totally different things and that we cannot have the same mind. But it's important to having an understanding to each other's work, because, of course, I know they're trying to hunt drug dealers. And maybe some of our drug users also drug dealers, I don't know. But this is what they are doing, this is their work. but they also have to understand that we are doing harm reduction and that we try to reduce the harm among drug users, and that drug use itself, if you don't harm anybody, I mean, why would you try to fight it? So yeah, they're, I think their most important job is to fight like criminal organized crime groups and stuff like that, and then you have drug users like the end products, which they shouldn't care as much as maybe think they are.
Yeah, complex process, I believe. And since you are with DrogArt, the harm reduction organization in Slovenia, how has this cooperation that Yuri mentioned developed during the last 9 or 10 years since you were there? Is there like more trust over the years?
Collaboration with the system, you mean?
Yeah, with the system, yes.
Yeah, I think we managed to position ourselves with the drug checking in a way that for sure we provide a lot of useful information with the monitoring. So now we know what really is on the market. Before, we just have this information that people told us, but it's still a discrepancy between what people think they're using and what are they actually using. So now we have really clear sight of what is on the market. So with the system, of course, they are funding us, so we can also collaborate more to prepare some responses, quick responses in the, if we see some trends that can be problematic. So I think it benefits everyone. But at the end, with this type of collaboration, you really have to be understanding to other services and other jobs that are there. But it was quite difficult. We needed a lot of conversations, a lot of promotion, why drug checking is important. But now, after, I think we're running now for in this shape, so that it's very quick from getting the results, that we have our own chemists, stuff like that. It's from 2018, so it's now 6 years. And we can see now the positive effects also on the population. We also did the research, and we saw that there is a positive behavior change after people using the drug checking service, that they really throw away the substance, for example, if it's not what they think it should be, or they reduce the amount. So with this research and monitor, I think we made a good case of a good practice, that now we position ourselves in a good way among the system, which is also signing the protocol. So
As in any other stuff, probably the beginning was the hardest, you know, trying to convince the authorities that this is something good. But now that you have data, now that you have research, now that you have feedback from the field, it's a lot easier, and now it's gonna go even better.
Yeah, it's always a problem to start something, and usually some bad thing has to happen that, you know, something moved forward. Also, it was the same with the story with drug checking in Slovenia. Oh, it started a long time ago, I think already 2006 or something. I was not yet there at DrogArt, but it was connected to one death that happened in a festival that was connected to an ecstasy pill. And this was the first collaboration between DrogArt and police, and they come together and say, okay, we have to do something. And then DrogArt tried to find this pill, and we managed to find it. And then the pill was sent to the forensic lab, so the police lab, just to check if there is some dangerous compound. So this was first kind of drug checking that was sample seized from a user for a health benefits, not to make some offense from the police. And this how story begins. And then slowly we needed like 15 years that we came to this point. So it take us a lot of time and resources, and but drug checking is developing also in Europe, and we are now under one network and everything. I think it's much easier now. It's more and more politics seeing that this is very important harm reduction service.
Do you remember what was in that pill?
No, I was not yet in Drogart, and I don't know exactly what was the result. But I think it was MDMA, and that the girl died from brain edema.
Oh, yeah.
What does that mean?
This is like one. Also, we informed these users, like, if you drink too much water, MDMA, it influences also your hormone that is responsible to keep water in your body. And especially with girls, it's problematic. So you can contain water while you're on MDMA. Usually people have problems peeing while they're on MDMA. This is like the effect. And as you have dry mouth and you're dancing and sweating and there is maybe high temperature in clubs, people tend to drink a lot of water. And if you just drink water, you can drink too much. And the water goes into your cells. And this is totally fine when the cells are in your arm because you just get a bit swelled. But it happens that water goes in your brains. Brains are surrounded by the skull, which is like not movable. And then there is some, it can happen that some part of the brains get some pressure, and these parts maybe can be responsible for, I don't know, breathing, and then it can be damaged. So yeah, this is harm reduction that we say drink like maximum 0.5 liter of water per hour if you are dancing, and to eat salt, which also helps that water stays outside the cells. So yeah, this is harm reduction in practice.
And for next year, we are now at the end of 24 while we are filming this. Are there any new technologies and new approaches to harm reduction and substance testing that you are planning to implement in the next year, or let's say next few years?
I think in the field of drug checking, we already have like the highest possible methods that we can have that are developed in the chemist field. So I don't think we could improve in terms of new technology. We could accept more samples, but this costs money. So I don't know if we will be able to do that. But there is a new project going on, which is not Drogart part of it, but I'm a bit following it, that there will be kind of drug checking for steroid users, so for anabolic steroids. As there is also unregulated market, we collected few samples in 2019 or something from anabolic steroid users, and we noticed the same problem. So there are different adulterants, and there are different products that are labeled like oxandrolone, but there is some other steroid. So we noticed that this might be a problem. So we reported this to Ministry of Health and asked, what should we do with this population, as we don't do this harm reduction in the recreational sport and performance enhancement products. So from the drug checking, we noticed this, and now Ministry of Health, they managed to get money to tackle this problem. So maybe it will expand this type of service. So this is also maybe an answer to previous questions where we positioned with this drug checking, that we can see very useful things also in the other populations.
Yeah, because there's a lot more substance use, like in performance enhancement drugs in recreational sports than there are in professional sports.
Yeah.
So it's in crazy. A way, it's also beneficial, you know, because people are going to be using it anyway. So might as well get a service to reduce the harm the same as you're doing here.
Yeah, I agree totally. But yeah, many times steroids just slip out of all the services. I was looking if there is somebody already doing some harm reduction or if there is any information in Slovenia regarding recreational steroid use, but there is none. So, you know, imagine like young people entering this world. I guess they are, probably learned by peers or by, I don't know, some trainers in the gym or something. But I don't know if they can have any credible information they can find to see what's going on. Like, it's for drugs now. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a problem.
And as I understood you, there's going to be another like part of the government that is going to regulate just that. So it's going to be you, Drogard, which is a whole other sphere. And there's also going to be Drogard for steroid users.
I don't think Drogard will expand to steroid area, as it's, I think you need a lot of resources and a lot of knowledge. So this project for now, I think will go more or less just into testing, just provide this service. But yeah, we will see. For sure, I will try to promote that there should be harm reduction as well. But as we are not part of the partners in the project, then we will see. But yeah, it's quite difficult to start something new, you know.
Okay, but we can still say that, like, as a society, we are making steps, you know, into at least on one area, let's say, to a better or more safer space.
Yeah, I would say. And I would say also that Slovenia is quite progressive in terms of this, as we collaborate also with people from other countries. And our drug checking service is totally comparable with Swiss, that we always wanted to be. And for example, Austria and Spain. And then you have many countries that still don't have drug checking. For example, Croatia, also Germany was forbidden to do drug checking, or it's still now, or maybe they now allow it. So yeah, it's still a bit controversial service, as some people can see it. Yeah, you promote drug use because people can check it and then they will use it. But the idea is that if they bought it already, they tend to use it. So it's not that somebody will buy drugs because they can check it, you know. Nonsense.
Okay. Well, if you ask me, we went through all of the topics that we prepared. Maybe to kind of finish it off easily, I would like to ask you what were some of your personal lessons from last year? What did you learn working here personally and professionally?
Oof. What did I learn? That's a tough question. I think I'm so long already in this field that nothing surprised me anymore. But maybe I learned that, now I'm collaborating a bit more with the system. So with people who make policies and this type of people, that there is like a very different point of view of, you know, they get the data from us or from other research, but the idea how it in reality really drug use, you can observe it. I don't think they have an idea how people are really using drugs, because I was talking with our chemist, for example, and sometimes we discuss about several samples and you assess the risk if you find something, but you also have to have this knowledge that, you know, that some people are using maybe 2 grams of cocaine through one night. But he said, but this is not a problem because, yeah, I see that this middle dose for cocaine is like 50 milligrams. So this adulterant is just like, so it's like 5%. So it's not a problem. So his idea is that people who use cocaine, they use 50 milligrams and that's it. And then they are satisfied for, I don't know, next experience. So yeah, they really don't have an insight how things are in reality. So this is, I think, sometimes for me hard, and you have to always balance between, you know, you shouldn't be too explicit. Today I was very open. When you are working with the system, you have to be careful a bit that people tend to have their own personal point of view as they are high in this system. It can be their choice just to say no to something. So you really have to know how to use words and how to promote things in a way that will be effective. This is what I'm learning, I think, from the last year. It's not very open that I could just say, yeah, people are using a lot of drugs, like 10 different substances in one night, and they would go, oh, we have to forbid everything.
Yeah.
But this is the reality, and they are working in the offices. I don't think they ever went to a party.
Get it. Yeah, so you have to be able to speak the language, not your language most of the times, but the language of the person that you are trying to convince them of something, of trying to convey a message, you know, if that's your goal. So yes, that's a good thing. That's also something I'm learning in my field.
Yeah.
Your organization and stuff. Yeah, it's a pretty general people skill that I think it's very useful on a normal. So yeah, Yuri, do you have anything else?
No, I don't think so. I think, I have a lot of questions, but we could then talk for another 3 hours. I think I asked what I meant to ask during the conversation. So I'm good here.
Okay, cool. So thanks a lot. And that's it until next time when we do another episode.
All right. Another party. Somewhere.
Yeah, another party.
Okay. Thank you, guys.